Happy New Year! This is the BBC History Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Continuing with our New Year's stories, the changing shape of slimming. Losing weight is one of the most common New Year's resolutions, with many pledging to shed the pounds in January. But since the 1940s, slimming clubs have provided emotional succor, drawn criticism, and even reinvented themselves, proving there's a lot more to the history of dieting than weight loss. By Katrina Mosley. On September 16, 1967, a local paper in Surrey ran a weight loss story about a woman named Stephanie Vaughn. Having struggled with her body weight as a child and adolescent, Stephanie had grown fatter and more hopeless about her weight problem until, at 21, she reached 14.5 stone. She had tried everything in her willpower to diet. She had even taken a course of slimming pills, which left her feeling terrible. But recently, reported the newspaper, something dramatic had happened. Stephanie had discovered a new slimming method called Weight Watchers, an organization recently introduced to this country from America, which helps fatties through group therapy, a kind of Eaters Anonymous. The article in the Surrey Comment went on to record Stephanie's remarkable success with Weight Watchers. She had started going once a week to a meeting in a small village hall in Datchet, where a new branch of the company had just been formed. Although she had already slimmed down to 13 stone, she hoped to stay for 5 further months to lose more weight. The journalist concluded that Stephanie felt better in herself and found it easier to resist sweet temptations. Where she once had been a fat girl, too big to go out and buy pretty off-the-peg clothing, she had started taking an interest in fashion, and now there is a chance of finding something to fit. This newspaper story captures an important moment in the late 1960s, when new dieting methods were emerging in Britain. And although today we are very familiar with the idea of a slimming club, their history is largely overlooked. How did the idea of group-supported weight loss first catch on? Clubbing together. Slimming clubs have a long social history dating back to post-war America. The first of these groups, the nonprofit organization Taking Off Pounds Sensibly, was established in Milwaukee in 1948, and similar companies followed in the 1950s. In 1963, a savvy businesswoman named Jean Nidecht established Weight Watchers, Inc. in New York, charging members a weekly attendance fee for the guidance that she provided. This model proved wildly successful, and 4 years later, an American woman named Bernice Weston bought an exclusive franchise to operate Weight Watchers in Britain. Weston's story is recorded colorfully in her autobiography, A Weight Off My Mind. Age 27 in 1966, she stumbled upon a session of Weight Watchers while on holiday in Miami with her English husband. Having yo-yo dieted throughout her life, she vowed to give the group method a go. Although her first encounter was an unpromising one, we actually arrived clutching hamburgers, dripping with ketchup and relish, and drinking triple-thick milkshakes. Her dedication soon melted away the unwanted pounds. She returned to England several months later to spread the word about Weight Watchers from her home in Surrey. Nevertheless, success was not immediate. Weston struggled to drum up business at first, attracting just 3 women to her initial UK meeting in March 1967. In the autumn of that year, she organized a fashion show for former Weight Watchers at a department store in Kingston-upon-Thames. The models had all slimmed down with the support of the organization, and Weston arranged to have a huge blow-up done of their before and after pictures for the purposes of promotion. During this early phase, Weston trained each new lecturer herself. Lecturers were former members of Weight Watchers, women who had successfully lost weight on the program and wanted to set up a new class in a nearby area. Once training was complete, these women called on friends to take part in their classes. Like other American imports such as Avon and Tupperware, Weight Watchers drew on established networks of female sociability and provided new income-generating opportunities for women. Over time, the success of Weight Watchers paved the way for the emergence of homegrown groups in Britain. Silhouette Slimming was established in Northamptonshire in 1968, and a year later, a woman named Margaret Bramwell established J&M Slimming World in a church hall in Derbyshire. By 1975, there were around 570 branches of Weight Watchers across the UK and more than 1,000 different classes of Silhouette Slimming Club Limited, pulling them in. By the early 1980s, the strength of the slimming club industry was plain to see. Talking to researchers in that decade, one woman commented, "I recently had a market research job to find off the streets of Nottingham 10 women who had never been members of a well-known slimming club and interview them. Impossible task? On the face of it, yes. To get 10 at random like that. It took me just 3 hours. I was amazed. At that rate, I could have got on pulling them in all day." The success of these clubs helped their female founders rise to prominence too. Rosemary Conley, who left school at age 15 and entered secretarial work, found huge success with a chain of slimming clubs in Lancaster in the early 1970s. By the late 1980s, she was living in an 18-room mansion in the countryside. By 1991, with book contracts and television deals, she was earning more than £1 million a year. We can add Conley to a long line of enterprising women: Helena Rubinstein, Madam C.J. Walker, Elizabeth Arden, and Anita Roddick, who harnessed the power of female consumption patterns across the 20th century to make large fortunes for themselves. Identifying a gap in the market for innovation, these women helped to transform the masculine face of entrepreneurial leadership. One of the reasons why slimming clubs were so successful in this period is that they meant more to women than weight loss. Instead, they were spaces of female homosociality, where friendships were formed and women could share their problems and secrets, rather like the pubs that men gathered in to drink and socialize across the early 20th century. In the early days, eager to protect these female-only spaces, some slimming clubs even went as far as to exclude men. When I interviewed Rosemary Conley, she recalled that her own classes were targeted at women, absolutely women, and if men had wanted to come, you'd have to say no. Keep Fit classes were another space that fostered female friendships in this period, and they shared many similarities with slimming clubs. Formed in an association in 1956 by the exercise guru Elaine Fowler, they grew to prominence in the late 1950s, gaining publicity from Fowler's motivational appearances on BBC radio and television. A suggestion to insert ladies into the title of the Swindon Keep Fit branch was approved unanimously upon its founding in the mid-1960s. Mate, not plate. In the 1970s, all slimming clubs followed a simple business format. Each club generated revenue through monthly membership and weekly attendance fees. Classes took place in hired spaces, typically village halls, and in return for their money, members received a mixture of dieting resources, tailored food plans, calorie information guides, a weekly weigh-in, and the emotional support of fellow slimmers. This last factor, emotional support, was crucial. According to Bernice Weston, slimming clubs were places where private problems were shared and unpackaged as a group. We would discuss why we ate, and frequently we found that we were unhappy at home. All kinds of problems were revealed when a member confessed to cheating. Perhaps a woman could admit she was facing a divorce, or that a parent was dying, and as usual, food became their only solace. In the early days, Weston would even hand out fridge stickers saying things like, "Who are you angry with?" explaining, "When you're angry with someone, the first thing you do is go straight to the fridge." To protect against evening blowouts, another sign cautioned women to reach for their mate, not their plate. Its tagline, "Make love, not midnight snacks." Talking therapies. Though these examples may seem comical, the unique culture of slimming clubs could serve as an important function for women. Slimnastics classes founded in Richmond in the 1960s combined fitness and healthy eating advice with talking therapy. As one of the group's founding members, Diana Lumpluff, later explained, Slimnastics paired together women with similar personal problems. This has happened, for instance, with two mothers whose babies died in cot deaths, another where, sadly, two elderly mothers share the horror of having their sons commit suicide. By encouraging open communication, these clubs preempted later cultural concerns with stress management and emotional well-being. The reasons for attending a slimming club were not always this profound. Many women maintained a lighthearted attitude to participation, viewing their weekly meeting as a welcome opportunity to meet with friends or to escape domestic drudgery. Interviewed for a study on food in the early 1980s, a housewife from the north of England admitted that her own slimming club journey had been a farcical one. Me and my friend used to go to the slimming club on a Thursday night with about 90 pounds. We used to come out of there, go to the pub, have some fish and chips on the way home, and then slim the rest of the week. This, she explained, was her night out. It was something that she looked forward to because her husband always insisted on staying in. At the other extreme, some women found the experience of attending a slimming club stressful and anxiety-inducing. In 1985, at the age of 21, Jackie Long joined a weight loss club with friends in her local town in Cheshire. When interviewed later in life, she recalled that meetings could be a bit cringeworthy. The class leader would actually go around the room, and she would ask everyone what they had lost or maintained or put on, to the point where I can remember feeling quite sort of sick, hoping that I'd lost. Although slimming clubs constructed weight loss as a positive process, aspects of the dieting experience could clearly be psychologically damaging, and the women's liberation movement provided a new framework for feminist women to express these concerns. Although the movement itself dated back to the 1960s, critiques of the dieting industry found fuller expression towards the end of the 1970s with the publication of Susie Orbach's book, Fat is a Feminist Issue, 1978. This seminal book on dieting linked issues of disordered eating to patriarchal culture and power structures. For Orbach, a British psychoanalyst, ideals of thinness were transmitted unconsciously to girls from an early age. Rather than reproducing to such beauty ideals, it was the task of modern feminists to outroot them as part of a broader effort to combat the sexual objectification of the female body. A recipe for outrage. By the early 1980s, these ideals had trickled down into the radical feminist press. Trouble and Strife magazine, launched in 1983, featured an article on the politics of slimming in its opening issue. One thing sticks in my mind, observed the author, the description in Slimmer magazine of this year's Golden Slimmer of the Year, who is transformed by her diet from a lump of lard in the corner into a winner. The misogynistic tone of the article made her reel. You've been listening to BBC History Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. By the 1980s, the arguments of the American body positivity movement, which asserted that all people deserve to have a positive body image, regardless of societal expectation, were becoming evident in Britain. Nancy Roberts' exercise classes were launched in London in 1982, aimed not at weight loss, but at encouraging big women to enjoy their bodies, according to an article in 1983. And later in the decade, the London Fat Women's Group took to BBC television to create a program that would challenge the slim ideal presented by the media. Many of the women involved in such groups had themselves attended slimming clubs in the past. After years of dieting, observed the Radio Times in 1989, they are trying to come to terms with how they are and want to challenge the oppression they face. Through activities of this kind, larger women shaped a more cynical view of the dieting industry through the 1990s and into the 21st century. This brings us up to the present day. What do slimming clubs look like now in the 2020s? The messages expounded by dieting clubs have, of course, changed shape over time, in line with the broader cultural shifts. In the 1960s, there was a lot of talk of beauty, clothes sizing, and appearance. But nowadays, there is much more of an emphasis on health. This was reflected clearly in 2018 when Weight Watchers rebranded itself WW, adopting the new tagline, Wellness That Works. And rather than being the sole preserve of women, men are now welcome into slimming clubs, with more attending than ever before. The technique adopted by dining clubs have also evolved in recent decades. The 1990s marked a new visual age for slimming, with the spread of fitness videos and television features. Then came the rise of the online diet club, allowing members to meet virtually and track their weight loss journey through mobile apps. And now, the boon in effective weight loss drugs, such as Ozempic, have ushered in a new chapter in the history of slimming, forcing many to ask, will slimming clubs become defunct altogether? Slimming clubs offer us a rich history of contradictions, whether we side more with the arguments of the women's liberation movement or more with the notion that beauty is power, is perhaps a moot point. For all of these themes, patriarchy, misogyny, female agency, and female expression figure somewhere along the way. Up next, The Mummy's Curse and Other True and False Tales. Booby-trapped tombs, eviscerated corpses, and terrifying curses. Countless facts swirl around the burial practices of ancient Egyptians, but which are based in fact and which are a tissue of lies. It's time to unwrap the truth about mummies by Campbell Price. First, the aim of mummification was preservation. False, sort of. Generations of schoolchildren have been taught that ancient Egyptians treated remains of high-status individuals to preserve them for the afterlife. Yet this idea is shaped by modern, which is to say modern Western, cultural expectations of what the dead should look like, linked to the fact that the first Europeans to investigate ancient Egyptian mummies in the 18th century were themselves interested in embalming techniques. These researchers were keen to preserve their own dead just as they have been in life, so they looked as if they had simply fallen asleep. Even today, people take comfort from this approach. The ancient Egyptians, however, did not intend their dead to be seen by the living, and were apparently less concerned with preserving the transitory appearance of a human during their lifetime. Rather, they focused on transforming the body into an enduring and perfect effigy resembling one of their immortal gods. None of the gory details of mummification are depicted in Egyptian art. Instead, our knowledge comes from the Greeks and Romans, both morbidly fascinated by mummies, who left accounts of a practice they thought weird. They describe how mummification dehydrated the body, made it hard and brittle. Once anointed with scented oils, the body resembled the expensive wood from which sculptures of the gods were carved. In ancient texts, Egyptian deities are said to explicitly have flesh of gold, bones of iron or silver, and hair of lapis, a blue semi-precious stone. So those who could afford it might be supplied with a gilded mask and a blue painted hair covering to emulate those divine features. The facial appearance of a mummy mask is the product of the shaping of plaster and linen on an idealized and reusable mold, so it was never intended to be an accurate likeness of the deceased. In inscriptions, the dead are often referred to in divine terms, with men and women alike given the designation Osiris, the god of rebirth. From around 300 BC, women alone were referred to as Hathor, also known as the Golden One, the afterlife goddess par excellence. For the wealthy, therefore, mummification was about transformation in order to achieve immortality, not about preserving the body in the form of that person while alive. Ancient Egyptians mummified their pets to accompany them into the afterlife. False. The people of ancient Egypt were widely believed to have been great animal lovers. Greek and Roman visitors to the Nile Valley viewed what they saw as excessive devotion to the creatures as yet another of the Egyptians' odd traits. This is why, for example, the Greek historian Herodotus recorded that when a cat in an Egyptian household died, everyone in that household shaved off their eyebrows. However, keeping a relatively domesticated feline to control vermin is not quite the same as coddling a pet cat. In ancient Egypt, animal forms were a means of expressing and communicating with the divine. Only in rare cases were they viewed as worthy of specific veneration. A single living bull was the focus of several religious cults throughout Egypt, notably at the site of Saqqara, near the prominent city of Memphis in the north, where a succession of sacred Apis bulls were kept over many centuries. Asked if he wanted to visit the bull on a tour of his newly conquered territory in 30 BC, the future Roman Emperor Augustus declined, saying he was accustomed to the worship of gods, not cattle. Pet ownership was limited to a few apparently domesticated animals given personal names, the most famous example belonging to a prince named Thutmose, who had a stone sarcophagus created for a cat named Tammu, literally the she-cat, in the 14th century BC. However, this was highly unusual, and there is no evidence that Tammu was buried with the prince. In fact, the tens of millions of mummified animals known from ancient Egypt were almost all raised for slaughter as wrapped gifts to the gods. Depending on the sacred animal of the intended divine recipient, you could give a cat, a crocodile, a fish, a falcon, or even a shrew. Each was an appropriate offering, even in cases where the mummified bundle didn't actually contain an animal inside. Most important was that the mummy was associated with, or in the image of, one of the gods. Victorians used mummified remains as paint, and mummified cats were used as fertilizer. True. The Egyptian dead have been used for purposes they could never have imagined and would probably have feared. Indeed, many modern treatments of mummified remains make tomb robbery seem the preferred option. For a mummy left untouched for thousands of years, a museum was in some ways a stable destination, if not one where it could be guaranteed to stay intact. Scientific examination of mummies has included dissection, in some cases resulting in various parts of one body being placed into hundreds of sample jars across several institutions. Other desecrations have been rather more commercial. Pulverized Egyptian mummified bodies and bandages were used to produce a deep earthy brown pigment favored by the artists of the 19th century. Mummy brown paint was commonly found in artist studios and was being produced as recently as 1964. Pre-Raphaelite painter Edward Burne-Jones was so horrified upon discovering the origin of the pigment that he gave one tube of the paint a respectful burial in his garden. Linen wrappings, presumably the least discolored ones, were reportedly shredded and pulped for use in paper mills in the U.S. in the mid-19th century. Around the same time, mummified bodies were burned as fuel for the railway system in Egypt. This practice was observed by Mark Twain, who reported that because of the lack of trees in Egypt and the high price of coal, mummified bodies were purchased by the ton or by the graveyard to power locomotives. Mummified humans were not the only victims. The remains of an estimated 180,000 mummified cats from near the site of Beni Hassan in Middle Egypt were shipped to the port of Liverpool in the early 1890s. Used as ballast on both the SS Pharos and the SS Thebes, 19.5 tons of unwrapped felines, the linen bandages had been put to other uses, were sold to farmers as fertilizer, with a few being donated to a Liverpool museum. In fact, the word mummy is derived from mamaya, an Arabic Persian term for a black mineral substance, often referred to as bitumen, which occurred naturally in Iran and was thought to have curative properties. This was linked to a black, resinous goo applied to the bodies of the ancient Egyptian dead, or at least to the bodies of those who could afford to have such an expensive concoction poured over them. Later recipes for the substance may have contained traces of bitumen, showing a certain circularity in the association. Most alarmingly, the confusion between curative mineral and mummification resin led to the active acquisition and atomization of ancient Egyptian corpses for consumption as medicine in the Middle Ages and later. Mummia was even sold as a treatment for sexually transmitted diseases such as syphilis. Suffice to say that medicated cannibalism never really did anyone any good. The plots of the most famous mummy movies date back to ancient times. True. Modern films about ancient mummies may have seemed to have been products of their times, betraying deep-seated colonial anxiety about the repercussions of disturbing ancient tombs and claiming the spoils in the name of science. Undoubtedly, the image of the animated mummy as a shuffling, unclean menace seems to date from the Victorian era. Yet the inspiration for one of the major tropes in the mummy fiction is much older. The plot of the 1932 Universal Studios film, The Mummy, centers on the reanimation of an ancient Egyptian named Imhotep, played by Boris Karloff. The best-known historical Imhotep was widely revered as a sage and healer and as the mastermind behind the first pyramid built in the 26th century BC. In the Karloff movie, Imhotep is brought back to life by an archaeologist, hungry for knowledge and ignorant of the potential consequences, who reads from an ancient scroll. The crucial plot point does in fact derive from an ancient source, a folktale written down about 2 millennia ago, today known as the Tale of Setne, which was inspired by a real person. The historical prince is known to have been to be something of an archaeologist himself, touring ancient monuments, including pyramids, and adding identifying inscriptions. In the folktale, his thirst for knowledge leads him to search the Book of Thoth, in which he finds buried in the tomb of an ancient prince. Possessing the book gets him into trouble, bringing the owner of the tomb and the scroll back to life. More recent retellings, including the latter 1959 Hammer film and the 1999 blockbuster, both also called The Mummy, hinge on the same plot point, reading forbidden knowledge from the Book of the Dead. Few viewers realize that the story is some 2,000 years old. You've been listening to the BBC History Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Remember, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast or audio on demand. You can also take Sunsounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sunsounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Music is Classical Royal Music by D'Lo Sound. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.